You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It's John Gibbons for the Anfield Wrap, and we felt we wanted to put something out in the follow-up to yesterday's collapsed Hillsborough trial that left a lot of people angry, confused, frustrated, but also, unfortunately, anyone who's followed the campaign for justice not particularly surprised. To help us look at yesterday and how we arrived there is Professor Phil Scraton, who I'm sure lots of you will know was a member of the Hillsborough Independent Panel and is also the author of Hillsborough, The Truth. So thanks very much for joining us this morning, Phil. I appreciate it.
No, thank you very much as well for having me on. It's a really important moment, John. And, you know, we are now at the real crossroads because the criminal justice process has formally ended.
And ended fairly abruptly, I would say, Phil. And there was a lot of frustration that this trial in particular wasn't even seen to the end. In fact, it was thrown out by the judge. Can you explain to people how this has happened? Because obviously a lot of people are seeing an independent panel prove once and for all the truth of what happened, well, both on that day and also in the aftermath. And then they're seeing in a court of law that information gathered on altered statements in one place don't seem to count in another.
I'll start at the end, really. I'll start by yesterday and the ruling that came yesterday. And it was a coincidence, or was it, that he prevaricated on his judgment until the day when evidence was being given in London on a particularly significant issue in the recent recent Tory party's shenanigans. And of course, today's newspapers will carry Hillsborough lower down the pages than would have been the case had that not happened yesterday in London. I don't know whether that was too much of a coincidence or what. Sometimes when you get to this stage in cases like this, you almost see conspiracy at every corner. I think that the one thing I want to start with is Justice William Davis's comments yesterday. He found effectively that the statements, and I'm reading this, had been prepared for a public inquiry, which he then goes on to say did not constitute a court of law, which is accurate, obviously. Thus, there would be no perversion of the course of justice. What he's saying is, had the statements that were prepared by the South Yorkshire Police, reviewed and altered by the South Yorkshire Police, then handed to the West Midlands Police investigators for all that followed, had they been being prepared for a criminal justice process, they would have had validity. But they don't have validity because they were being prepared, he argues, for a public inquiry. So it's very simple, it's very straightforward. He made it sound simple because it is simple. So the first question has to be, why has it taken all this time for him, knowing this trial was going to come about, to make that decision? Why have families been left for 4 years waiting for a trial? And also, we have to say, those who were being prosecuted have waited for a trial all this time. The trial was allowed to start. And having started, it's abandoned on a point that was self-evident. from the get-go. So, you know, I found this remarkable. So on the one hand, it's appalling that the families have been let down again, the survivors have been let down again. It's appalling that people thought that somebody was going to be held at least accountable for what happened in the aftermath of Hillsborough. But the reality is, it should never have got to this stage, according to his ruling. According to his ruling, this should have been known right from the outset. If the course of justice was going to be perverted by the introduction of evidence that was taken for another reason, well, that's been known forever. We know that the statements were taken and they were given to every process. They were given to the coroner's inquest. They were the basis of the decision made by the West Midlands Police on whether there should be prosecutions way back in 1990. And they decided against that. So why has it taken the best part of three decades and an immense cost, both financial cost, but also personal cost, for this to occur, you know, in 2021? How on earth has that happened? It also gave rise to one of the lawyers, Jonathan Goldberg, who was representing Peter Metcalfe, who was the solicitor involved in the review and alteration of statements, making a statement yesterday that took us back three decades. It reversed the Hillsborough narrative by three decades. I just want to concentrate on the words that he used. The fans' behavior was perfectly appalling, causing a riot, which led ultimately to innocents being crushed to death. Now, just thinking about that, one third of the people who died came through the gate that was opened by the police. So are they innocent or are they guilty? Because what he goes on to say is, it is always the innocents who suffer. And then he says, the families have been wound up with awful political statements that had no basis in reality. A complete conspiracy theory that's a nonsense. So he's saying that all the work that's been done, not by people just like by people like me, although he seems to assume that the families have got no will of their own, nobody understands Hillsborough better than the Hillsborough families and the Hillsborough survivors. I have a good technical knowledge and I know their case, but nobody understands the reality. And yet he can stand there after all this time, not only make repeat false allegations, but demean the family's intelligence, demean the families and the survivors' understanding of what happened on that day, but also get the facts wrong. And it's a dreadful situation that takes us back three decades, that places innocence on the one hand and guilt on the other. And the fact that he was able to do that on prime time, Radio 5, with a well-known and well-established BBC presenter who didn't challenge him, who let it go and is now full of remorse for doing that, only because there is an outcry, actually typifies Hillsborough. Because what it set off yesterday was this massive Twitter feed which took us back those 30 years where people who should know better or don't know anything were writing, there you are, we told you, it was the fans. What that's done to survivors and the bereaved, those who are still alive, is appalling. So that I wanted to say that right at the head of our discussion, because it really does strongly contextualize where we are today. And then I'll go on to talk about the background.
Before you do, Phil, I think it's worth stressing your point further by saying that people have largely been silenced for the last 4 or 5 years. Well, for 30 years, but especially the last 4 or 5, where they've been told, "Oh, don't say anything. It can prejudice a case. Don't say anything because you know it could. You know, it would have been instructed to do so, and have bitten their tongue." And that's what, you know, annoys me even more about what he said, really, is that he's apparently able to go on, as you say, on BBC Five Live and say lies, and they're proven to be lies now, whereas people who know the truth, you know, have been told, you know, that they're not allowed to discuss it.
There's no question that this was a twisting of the knife, but I want to also go back to the point you've just made, which is a crucial point, actually. It's really significant. And this isn't just personal, this is more broad. It is the silencing, okay? When the Duckinfield trial started, the first trial, there was an attempt to have Hillsborough the Truth, my book, taken off all the bookshelves until the end of all the trials. Now, because it had sold so much and because it was on Amazon, et cetera, that didn't happen. The judge allowed it to stay out there, but the Hillsborough Independent Panel's website was taken down. So since the early days of the prosecutions, all those years ago, the Hillsborough Independent Panel's website is not there. All of that evidence, all the vast array of statements that was on that website is not there. I've not been able to publish anything new. Not even a comment piece in the Echo since. The BBC was going to show Dan Gordon's film, Hillsborough, on the first anniversary after he'd released it. So that would have been 2018. The BBC withdrew it because it couldn't show anything on Hillsborough. Other films and documentaries have been made during this time. None of them have been shown. Other articles have been written, other books are in embryonic form, none of them have been published. What actually happened was that the minute that there was a decision taken to prosecute, all publishing went silent. So the silence starts with the inability of journalists, reporters, academics, filmmakers not being able to publish or film anything on Hillsborough on the one hand, and on the other hand, families and survivors being told, don't write anything on Twitter, don't write anything on Facebook, don't, whatever we do, we must not disturb the trial. And it is quite remarkable. It's quite remarkable that the families and survivors actually obeyed that. But now we have to say, 4 years on, all that debate didn't take place, should have taken place, but was silenced. So the silencing is unprecedented in legal history. We have never had a situation where the silencing of authors, the silencing of reporters, the silences of the Anfield Rap, the silence of the families and survivors, where that has happened over such an extended period of time. And I think that that's really an important, as you point out, it's a really important issue, John. And being yourself, you know, broadcasting yourself in depth on this issue for so long, you will have felt, you and the team will have felt immense frustration at being inhibited from being able to make even the slightest comment that might have any bearing on the case.
No, 100%. Let's talk a bit more about these altered statements then, because the judge can talk about how information was gathered and different processes, but knowledge of changed statements isn't new and certainly isn't new to you.
Well, I'll take you through the chronology of it, because I think people think that my own work personally began with the Independent Panel, which is not true. My own work personally developed a month and a half after the disaster. And I've worked with the families all the way through, and I'm going to come to it in a minute. It was me that uncovered the reviewed and altered statements. But I want to go back to Wednesday, the 19th of April, 1989. We're just days after the disaster. And you know where I'm going with this. The Sun leads with this appalling front page on the truth, the so-called truth. It wasn't the only newspaper. Seven other newspapers carried the same allegations, but just less prominently, stating that the fans had caused the disaster by forcing entry into the stadium, saying that the fans were drunk, that they'd picked the pockets of the dead, and that they'd urinated on police officers. We all know this trope now very well. But it plays a massive part in the real story. Because where did that story originate? And as I've shown in my own work, it originated with the Police Federation, the head of the Police Federation in South Yorkshire, with Irving Patnick, a Conservative MP for Sheffield Hallam, and with a senior South Yorkshire police officer. They, either together or singularly, went to White's News Agency, a local news agency that did all the work for Sheffield Wednesday Football Club, and they gave the story to White's. I have the original faxes in my possession. The faxes were White's news agency passes the story to the national media. So that's the Wednesday, immediately after the disaster. That's the start of it. At the same time that those newspapers were selling on the newsstands, the chief constable, in an unprecedented move, showed up at a meeting of the Police Federation. Chief constables don't usually go to the union's meeting. It's unprecedented. It was being held in a place called Pickwick's, which is a local restaurant. I have the transcript of that meeting. It's massive. But the most significant moment in it is when he tells them that because of his role as chief constable, he can't make what I will call the allegations against the fans, but the Federation could. So here we have a union meeting in which the boss actually tells the workers to do his bidding. And they did. So we've got these two things happening on the same day. We've got the Sun and other newspapers publishing the allegations, which have come, as I've said, from inside. And now some of those same people are in a meeting where what is being constructed is a new truth, the police version of events. So people would say, well, they'd do that, wouldn't they? They want to, you know, that what they want to do is they want to watch their backs. But that's not the issue, because within a couple of days after that, the South Yorkshire Police, under the direction of the same chief constable and his assistants, establish a team of officers. They are put under the overall command of David Denton, who is the head of management services and who's one of those who was prosecuted. He's instructed to gather police statements from all who were, all the police officers on the day, and to submit them to the force solicitor. The force solicitor is Peter Metcalf, working for the firm Hammond Sodarts. He's a partner. And what then happens is that the initial statements are taken, mostly in handwritten form. They're typed up, and then they go through a process of review and alteration by a team of officers. That team of officers are working to the instructions of David Denton, but they also have senior members, and they also have others involved, one of whom included Norman Betterson, by the way. And that team, he wasn't in the team, but he was a runner for the team. And then what happens is that the statements are gathered, they're reviewed, they're altered, and I have many of them here in my office. They're altered. They're taken back then to the police officer and said, this is the new type version with parts of the statements removed. Will you sign it? And they do. How can I be so sure of this? Because right here is a letter. And it's a letter on Hammond Sadat's newspapers, on a letterheaded notepaper, sorry. And it's to David Denton. And it's from Peter Metcalf, the fourth solicitor. And this is the fourth fax that he sent. I don't know how many more were sent, but it is an illustration of serial number 21. The officers worked in serials on the day of about 8 or 9 officers with a boss. And it pertains to 3 particular police officers. What's interesting is that the heading, which is consistent in all the statements, is, as before, the mention of a name without comment indicates that the statement has been read by the solicitors and that we have no suggestions for review and alteration. Now, down the years, the media has always questioned me and doubted me and said, we can't say that. And I said, we can say that because I'm not saying it. It's in the letter. And then attached to this is one of the statements which they suggest is a personal and graphic account, not necessarily suitable in its present form for submission as a factual statement to the West Midlands Inquiry. In other words, what this team of South Yorkshire officers were doing were putting together a submission to the external force that was investigating them, the West Midlands Police, so that when the West Midlands Police received all of the statements, and those statements then went on to inform all of the other legal processes, they had gone through an internal process of review and alteration. In this scale, this is unprecedented. Because the whole point of an external force investigating an internal force is that when they do that investigation, they come to it clear of any interference from the force. But what actually happened was South Yorkshire Police constructed the evidence, the statements, that then went to the West Midlands Police, that then went to the criminal prosecutions, went to the coroner, and so on. So that's what actually happened in terms of that established team of officers working with the fourth solicitor, their own head of management services. Now, years later, I met that police officer. I accompanied him to Stuart Smith when Stuart Smith held his inquiry, and Stuart Smith gave him a really hard time. He was very brave, in fact, putting his head above the parapet. And I'd met that police officer on several occasions walking on the Yorkshire Moors. And at the end of one of those occasions, he gave me his reviewed and altered statement. And it was the statement in all the forms. That's what led to me going to Stuart Smith. But when I realized that Stuart Smith, rather than accepting that this was a completely inappropriate process, he dismissed it. And by name, he spent 2 paragraphs dismissing me, as well as the police officer. It was only after that that I then managed to get access to all of the statements in all their forms, held in, well, I read them in the House of Lords, of all places, reading room. And I went through all of those statements. And that's why, I was just completing Hillsborough the Truth. That's why there is a whole section in Hillsborough the Truth that came from that visit. When I was in the House of Lords reading room, it's hard to actually express incredulity. I mean, you know, I look back at Hillsborough and there were so many incredible moments of disbelief. But honestly, when you've got all this, these willy-nilly boxes sorted out, and you've got all the statements in their proper place, and you start to compare them, and you see the lines being put through them by those editing, yesterday it was stated that it was only stuff that came out that might have embarrassed the families or somehow the supporters. But when you actually see a statement that says, not a good statement for the South Yorkshire Police, see officer regarding paragraph, 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 and all changed, and then all re-signed. There was only a couple of officers who refused to sign at the end of the day. When you see that, I was staggered. And what I did, in a nutshell, was I gathered up the core statements that I thought were really going to be to demonstrate the issue. I couldn't take them away. And I asked the library, I said I'd come back. I was there for 2 weeks. I said I'd be in the next day. Could I have these photocopied? And she looked at me and she said, oof. And I thought, oh, no, I'm not going to be able to get them. And she said, it'll cost you 10p a sheet. And my response was, do you take a card? And she said, oh, yes, certainly. And when I arrived the next morning, I had all of the statements I wanted copied with a House of Lords reading room stamp on the back of every page. It sounds dramatic, but I came back to Lime Street from Euston on a Friday night train that was packed, and I never let my case away from being between my legs because I was scared stiff. And the point of telling this story is when I get home, only my partner knew what I had. And we were up till the early hours of the morning going through, and I was explaining what I'd discovered. And then I went to bed. And after about an hour, only time I've ever done it in my life, I sat bolt upright and I shouted, they all knew. It had just only at that moment dawned on me that all of those involved, the external police force, West Midlands Police, the coroner, the CPS, DPP, the Home Office, the senior politicians, they all knew. They all knew that this process had occurred. In other words, it's a phrase I often use with my students, it's when something becomes beyond a group of individuals, it becomes institutionalized. They all knew. And that was the moment that I realized that A, they maybe hadn't done anything illegal. Yeah, it pushes the boundaries of legality, but they maybe hadn't done anything illegal, but certainly it had no moral underpinning. It was institutionalized up to and including the highest ranked officers in both forces, South Yorkshire Police and the investigating force. It was known throughout the whole process. They were all fully aware and they endorsed it. So that was my background. I published it in Hillsborough the Truth. And then the week that Hillsborough the Truth came out, the Sunday Mirror ran two center page spreads week after week, 2 weeks in a row. And the headline across the center pages was how the truth was censored. And quoting from my book and using facsimiles of the statements I brought home with me, they showed this to the nation. And I thought, this is it. This is the big moment, you know? And nothing happened. The trial happened in 2000 of the two most senior officers, Duckenfield and Murray. The trial failed. The promises by barristers that they would pick up the baton never occurred. They got on the train, went back to London, and nothing happened. And then we had, as you know only too well, as anybody in Liverpool knows, and anybody associated with Hillsborough knows, we had a decade of fallow years before we get to that fateful day when we had the memorial, 20th memorial, and there was Andy Burnham being booed on the cop and going back to Gordon Brown and saying something has to be done, and something was done. And then you all know the rest of that story, the negotiation of getting me onto the panel and the concerns about that and the attempt to keep me away from the panel and then being on the panel and then having the research based in my own university as opposed to another university where I would have to manage people I didn't know, and a whole chapter of the panel's report devoted to the review and alteration of statements. And the more detailed disclosure of that review and alteration, we had more time, we had more researchers, but also not only that, the discovery that the South Yorkshire ambulance service had, their statements had all gone through that process. Now, I knew this from an interview I'd done with SIMAS in the immediate aftermath at Hillsborough. I knew that their statements were being taken and they were being reviewed. What I didn't know was that they were being systemically altered. And so it wasn't just the police service, it was also the ambulance service. In other words, what was coming forward were very carefully orchestrated, was a body of evidence that was very carefully orchestrated. And that was that background. So, I mean, quite clearly, with all of the other 153 findings of the Hillsborough panel and the exoneration of the fans, quite clearly this played a major and significant part in our report. It also led very directly to the double apology from David Cameron, the apology from Theresa May, excellent speeches by Liverpool MPs, in Steve Rotherham especially, in Parliament, and Andy Burnham himself. And of course, it was as if now the train was on the tracks and the new inquests were ordered, new criminal investigation, a new IPCC, or now IOPC as it is called, investigation. They were all set in train at that moment. The new inquests, as we know, were informed by all of that. They weren't informed so much by the review and alteration of statements, but the questioning of witnesses, particular police witnesses, about their statements was underpinned by the knowledge of that review and alteration process. So we get to the end of the most memorable inquests in legal history, the longest inquests in legal history. And the verdict of the jury is, as we all know, unlawful killing. And in terms of the riders, over 20 riders directed, primarily against the police, but against all the other authorities as well, and the complete exoneration of the fans. Did the fans play any part in the disaster? No. So that was the moment. That was the moment. We'd had the panel's report, 153 clear findings, fans not responsible. We now had an inquest, 2 years, biggest inquest ever, fans not responsible. Clear indication of where the responsibility lay. But you couldn't look at the prosecutions with any hope, really, because not only was there a passage of time and we would have to establish beyond reasonable doubt the culpability of individuals, but also And people, yeah, people have died. But also the other significant issue would be who would you select for something that was so deeply institutionalized? The Crown Prosecution Service puts forward over 20 names. They're turned down by the DPP, and Duckenfield is the last man standing for the events that occurred on the day. Metcalfe was a safety issue. He was the club secretary. But the crucial issue was David Duckenfield. But he was the last man standing. What about all the others who were still alive? What about that list that was there presented for prosecution by the investigators and turned down by the CPS? What about that list? I know who was on that list, and I know what they were being accused of, but that was kicked into the long grass, and everybody focused on Duckenfield. And then we have a similar selection for the review and altered statements. Three people. The web of that review and altered statement stretched all the way to the top. It implicated senior officers. It implicated others of middle management status who were quite clearly involved, but it was three people. So it was always going to be a problem, because you're piling, as with Duckenfield, you're piling all the responsibility onto three people. Now, that's not to say they're not culpable. We all know that's the case. I've read out the statement. Review and alteration aren't my words. That was the process they embarked on. But clearly, and this is what this week demonstrated, was that taking what is absolutely questionable process, putting the weight on three people, and taking it to a criminal court where you have to be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that a crime has been committed, that in that situation, the plug is pulled, and the plug is pulled because it's considered that there is no appropriate charge of perverting the course of justice. Remember, that's what they were being tried for, perverting the course of justice. And because that's a criminal court case, what they did in the judge's eyes and in the submission that he received, what they did might not have been appropriate, but it did not amount to perverting the course of justice. The major question that has to be asked is how on earth, if that was the case, how on earth did it get this far? Why were those charges brought? You know, yesterday was about a judgment being made, not on what had happened in the court, but on the context of what happened in the court. And that context has been known for years. And given that some of the so-called best legal minds have actually been looking at this evidence over this period, including the judge himself, why wasn't this decision arrived at earlier? Why did bereaved families and survivors have to traipse all the way up to Manchester day on day, thinking that this was the final trial and that now somebody at least may be held responsible for some of what happened in the aftermath of Hillsborough? What I find remarkable is that we have probably the most serious peacetime tragedy, disaster, certainly the most expensive in terms of all that's gone on right through down the years. And I'm not criticizing that, because that's what it took, and that was right. And if it had all been handled in the first place, it wouldn't have cost the kind of money it did in the end. But it's the suffering that families and survivors have been put through in that process that really also, that's the real price. That's the real cost of Hillsborough, not the money. It's the suffering. And how did we get to a stage where on the one hand, we have a very clear statement that the fans were killed unlawfully. We have all of those responsible for that awful killing organizations listed. And yet, the only thing we have, other than that unlawful killing verdict, the 153 findings of the panel, the only thing that we have is one club secretary being successfully prosecuted for one relatively minor offence on safety issues. That's the issue.
So you mentioned a couple of times this morning, Phil, that this in theory is the end of the criminal prosecutions. This is the end of the road, if you like. There's an opportunity for civil things to happen, and they might do. But yesterday did feel like the end of the road in a lot of ways. And, you know, you saw the anger of Margaret Aspinall. You saw the frustrations from others. I spoke to some survivors left yesterday feeling, well, they just deserved better. They just deserved better than that. And a QC able to go outside and say, you know, the people he's representing have been exonerated, when we know they haven't, because you've held up to the evidence there in black and white. It's not that. It's a technicality, effectively, yes, they got off into. And I was just left, as I say, I saw Margaret Aspinall on TV and I spoke to a couple of people yesterday and I just thought, they deserve just so much better, not just because of what they've been through, but their conduct throughout the whole thing.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think the way in which the families and the survivors have conducted themselves throughout has been remarkable. And given the stress that they're under. And, you know, one of the things that concerns me a lot, John, is when people say, well, haven't they got over it? Or, you know, surely this brings closure. And you have to remind people that you cannot ever bring closure to, first of all, the deaths and the injuries, the near deaths of many survivors. And you can't bring closure, and nor should anyone try to bring closure, to the suffering that has followed. Especially when it's exacerbated by this long drawn out process over three decades. So now we have campaigners who weren't even born, but they were born into a family that was bereaved or survived. We have people who, I'm sure after yesterday, will go through a further process of trauma and upset and care and pain. And they'll hear Goldberg making these appalling allegations yet again. And they'll read the Twitter feeds yet again. So what it's done is it's reversed it. You know, in one sense, I know that people probably wouldn't thank me for saying this, but in one sense, I wish we could have drawn the line at the inquest. Of course we couldn't, and nor should have we, but that moment was a moment of real, it was a moment of real vindication for the families and for the survivors. I think that, going back to your other point, the criminal justice process is over. That's the end. There'll be no more trials, unless by some incredible reason something else was uncovered that demonstrated more clearly. But as you know, I mean, I've been through the literally millions of documents, and I can't see the strength in those documents for another trial other than the ones that we've had. The civil action is taking place, is going on. I have a bit of a concern about the civil action. I think it should go on, and I know why the families want it to go on. They want it to go on because if they can demonstrate in a civil court where the where the test of the evidence will not be as fierce as it would be in a criminal court. What I see happening there is the families wanting to have that story, the story of culpability and responsibility, clearly laid at the door of those institutions that I mentioned previously. And the civil court can do that by awarding damages. The families, I don't want to speak for the families, I never do, but I will say one thing. The families that I know, and that's many of them, are not in this for the money. And how dare any of the Fleet Street, as they used to be called, the Fleet Street reporters, how dare they ever raise that as an issue? They are in it because it's a court of liability. They're in it because by forcing damages, by forcing the debate through a civil court, and it will happen, and by achieving the award of damages, because remember, initially, damages were paid without liability. In the aftermath of Hillsborough, all these authorities, particularly the police, paid an undisclosed sum without liability. What does that mean? A donation like you would put on a plate in a church? You know? And let's also remember that the families, because so many of the of those who died were not adults and therefore didn't have jobs, they were given a nominal amount of money for a child's death. Scarcely enough to bury their loved one. And those who had to give up work, like one of my close friends, Eddie Spirit, who's now died in 2011 with the early onset of Alzheimer's, and that was undoubtedly caused by the injuries received, and Adam, his son, died in his arms. He was never able to work again because he was a taxi driver. Now, I'm not going to even begin to guess what the payment was, but I know it was paltry for what was his livelihood lost forever. He received, and that goes for so many of them. And those who were unemployed, of course, had virtually no claim at all. They were just given minimal damages. And I have again here in my archive, I have the letters from their then solicitors, not their recent solicitors, advising them to take these paltry sums because they would be more or less the best on offer, which was outrageous. So you can see how the system, the legal system, operates in a way that just makes families feel that they are the victims, they are the causes of the disaster. They are the causes of claims that somehow they carry a guilt for even receiving minimal paltry damages for the loss of a loved one. And they're trying to deal with their grief on top of that. And that's been the story of Hillsborough all the way through. And the glimmers of hope were the panel and the new inquests. I just hope that what happened yesterday, when the dust settles, that what happened yesterday, what happened over the Duckinfield trial, will not take away the massive victory that the families had in, first of all, getting the Hillsborough panel. And I know because I was associated with the letter that first went in to suggest an independent panel, and what happened in the inquests. And I just hope that, you know, that they will be seen as a mass of people severely hurt by the deaths of loved ones, a mass of others injured, rising up collectively and demanding. You know, we'll never forget that day when Andy Burnham stood up and the cop chanted justice. Yeah? Rising up as one, all differences aside, all politics aside, rose up as one to fight the state to fight the police and to fight all the other interested parties. And although it might not seem it this week, they won. They won. You know, you can't eradicate the report, the panel's report. You can't eradicate the inquest verdict. And what has happened over the prosecutions in no way reflects the truth and the justice and the acknowledgement of that truth and justice for the Hillsborough families and for the Hillsborough survivors.
I think that's a perfect place to finish. They did win and we know the truth. And that is partly thanks to you, Phil. So thanks a lot for all the work you've done over the years for the campaign. And thanks a lot for your time this morning at very short notice. Sports Social Podcast Network.